ladies and gentlemen, to this edition of the Hagmann and Hagmann Report. My daughter came during the break, and she whispered in my ear, and she said, I want you to say something for me. And I said, well, what's that, hon? She said, you make sure you thank everybody out there for their generosity, for their prayers, for their support, and especially thank those who don't even, I mean, look, just support us. I mean, thank the people who do support us, even by mentioning us to others. I guess I raised her right. We raised her right, correctly. Thank you. And heartfelt thank you from the bottom of our heart. It's not often we do this, but the fight is on. The battle has been engaged. And if I could tell you everything, I would, but I can't. The weaponization of the legal system is in full force. And,
yes, it is. And it's being used against us.
I'm not even sure we could admit that. Anyway.
Yeah, we can say that.
I guess so. And it's sad. It really is. Anyway, we have got such a wonderful show now here with, we've got, if you've never heard of answersingenesis.com, if you've never heard of this website, we found this website. John Robertson went after this like a pit bull and said, man, this is fantastic. The people, Dr. Snelling, Dr. Jensen, and Dr. Morrison, Answers in Genesis. You want to, because my daughter was having a conversation with others, zoologists actually, talking about creation and the scientific verification of the story of creation. Well, it's all here in Answers in Genesis. Now, we've got three people coming on, one right after in consecutive order. The first is going to be Dr. Snelling, and how we're going to do this, because the time is limited. I'm going to shut up here and just toss it to Joe for a very, very brief introduction. But this is going to be done in presentation form. In other words, there's not going to be a lot of back and forth here. We're going to allow the doctors to state their case, and the case is valuable. Give the information, and of course we'll jump in when necessary, but listen to what they've got to say. This is important.
Absolutely. Our first guest from Answers in Genesis is Dr. Andrew Snelling. He is a geologist. Mr. Snelling, Dr. Snelling, welcome to the Hagmann and Hagmann Report.
Hi there, good to be with you tonight.
Well, it's great to have you. If you could just take a few moments and give our audience a little bit of background about yourself.
Yes, well, you can tell I have an accent. Actually, I was born in the deep south of the other down under. I'm a native Australian. I was born in Sydney, Australia. I grew up in Sydney, Australia, and I studied at University of New South Wales and the University of Sydney, where I completed my PhD in geology. I worked for several years in the mining industry and doing field research. I was a consultant for some years for the Australian Nuclear Science and Technology Organisation on research projects that involved money and support from the US Department of Energy. And but for the last 30 or so years, I've been working in creation ministry. First of all with the Australian Answers in Genesis Ministry, and then for the Institute for Creation Research, which is now based in Dallas, Texas. And I've been now almost 10 years with Answers in Genesis in the US, and I've been living here now in northern Kentucky near the Answers in Genesis headquarters at the Creation Museum over 5 years now. My background, as I said, is in geology, and I've done a lot of research. Started going to the Grand Canyon back in 1990, and I've done something like 35 trips down the river and hiked the canyon a number of times, hiked upside canyons, had research and sampling permits granted by the National Park Service for doing research in the canyon, and published that research in a number of places. So I have a long history here of being involved in geology, different parts of the world, picking up rock samples, sending them to laboratories, doing analyses, answering different questions about the Earth's history, looking at the rocks that make up the Earth's surface. My position here at Answers in Genesis is the Director of Research. I run the research department, and I'm also the geologist on the team. So apart from doing research, I do writing, and I oversee publication. We have an online technical journal called the Answers Research Journal, which is online, so it's free. It's on our website. I also write for Answers Magazine, the lay publication of print publication of Answers in Genesis, write articles for the website, do speaking for the ministry in churches and university campuses, overseas as well. Last year I was in Peru and in England. So, yes, I keep pretty busy.
I guess so. Well, okay, Dr. Snelling, thank you so much for the introduction. And your website is just an incredible resource. And I should add, it's answersingenesis.org, although .com will take you there, but .org, answersingenesis.org. Dr. Snelling, fire away with the material that you have. And I know that it's a very specific topic specific, and you're going to be followed, of course, by Dr. Jensen and Dr. Mortensen. But with respect to your segment here, just we're going to let you go and present to our audience, and we've got listeners from your stomping grounds to the UK, to all across the United States and Canada. So fire off, and if you need us, we're going to be right here kind of acting as moderators.
Yeah, well, sure. What I did want to talk about was some of the research in the Grand Canyon and some of the controversy there that's erupted in recent years. But I've been involved in research, and about 15 years ago, I was helping a friend who was a river guide. He worked for one of the companies that run the raft trips down the canyon, and he put together a book that I contributed to on the evidence in the canyon. It wasn't a heavily scientific book. It was basically had lots of pictures in it, but short articles, and I contributed to that. And I'll come more to about the evidence in the canyon in a moment. But it got approval to be in the park's bookstores, and yet that created a controversy. And for some years, there's been a lot of effort to have that book removed from the park bookstores. Now, the park bookstores are not run by the National Park Service. They're run by an independent association. But nonetheless, there were those who were very upset about this book being there. It was the only book presenting a view on the canyon based on what the Bible says about the Earth's history and what we believe. And yet those who had plenty of other books in the bookstore presenting a view of millions of years were quite upset and irate about it. Well, just about 2 years ago, the book was not restocked in the park service, and it's in the bookstores, and it's been not allowed in the bookstores anymore there in the park. And instead, we've got there's a new book that's just come out that promotes the alternate view of an ancient Earth. And of course, it's been warmly received by the National Park Service for the bookstores, and which is very sad. In other words, they only want to promote one view, and yet we are adamant that there is a lot of evidence in the Grand Canyon to substantiate what the Bible says about the Earth's history. And one of the issues is that, well, first of all, the Park Service shouldn't be taking any particular viewpoint. They should be allowing freedom of expression. And we have every right to present our viewpoint, and we do so by presenting the science. And people will argue, well, hello, there's a big difference between believing in a global flood only 4,500 years ago and an Earth that's only about 6,000 years old versus millions of years. And so obviously there is scientific controversy, but we have to remember that the evidence we have exists in the present. We don't find rocks with labels on them saying, hi, I'm 100 million years old. We don't have fossils saying, I evolved into this other creature. All we find are the rock layers with the fossils in them. That's all. And so people come to the Grand Canyon, come to the rock layers with assumptions. And we're saying that our assumptions are valid, and because the Bible purports or claims to be the word of an eyewitness who was present. God was there. He told us what happened. And in fact, we can test what the Bible says against the evidence. In other words, we can look at what the Bible teaches about the past, and then we can go out and see whether the rocks and the fossils fit what the Bible teaches. Those who believe in a millions of years old earth and billions of years old earth, they weren't there in the past. They're only looking at the evidence. They have assumptions too. And their assumption is that the present is the key to the past, that the processes that we see operating today essentially have been responsible for producing the rock layers in the past. And so it's valid to ask, well, how did the Colorado River carve out the Grand Canyon? If the Colorado River is the means by which erosion is occurring today in the Grand Canyon, could it have carved out the Grand Canyon over millions of years? And the interesting thing is that the Colorado River is not carving out the canyon at the moment. Why? Well, the reason we can go down the river and go over rapids is because the Colorado River is not clearing out its channel. Those rapids are produced by flash floods in the side canyons that bring in boulders into the main channel of the Colorado River and impede the flow of the river. Now, at the moment, Bureau of Reclamation has released had another one of these high volume releases from Glen Canyon Dam. Normally they only allow between 12 to 20,000 cubic feet per second of water out from the dam down into the Colorado River to maintain its flow. But at the moment they're just doing a couple of days of 36,000 cubic feet per second. And what that does is it stirs up the sand on the bottom of the river, the bed of the river, and when the water level drops, it deposits that back up on the beaches. It renews the beaches, it cleans things out, but it doesn't move the rapids. Even the high volume flows, 100,000 cubic feet per second of known historical floods before the dams were put in, weren't capable of cleaning out the channel. So if the Colorado River is not clearing out its channel and eroding out these boulders today, how could it possibly have carved out the Grand Canyon? So this is a way we can test the evidence. The Bible says that all the high hills under the whole of the heaven were covered. Genesis chapter 7 describes the waters rising to cover the hills, and it says that all the high hills under the whole of the heaven were covered and the mountains were covered. Now, if that statement is true, what evidence would we expect to find? Wouldn't we expect to find that the ocean waters covered the continents? And the answer is we do. We go to the Grand Canyon, and the reason why the Grand Canyon is such a focus is there's very few places in the world where you've got such a deep cut into the earth with the rock layers so well exposed to view. And it's not just the Grand Canyon. You can go north of the Grand Canyon and there's further cliffs where you go further up the rock layer sequence. So you've got this stack of rock layers exposed in the Grand Canyon and to the north up through Zion and Bryce Canyon. And it gives you a very good slice of the geological record. And so what do we find? We find in those layers exposed in the walls of the Grand Canyon, we find marine fossils. That's right, marine fossils. And furthermore, these layers, many of them can be traced right across the continent and even beyond. At the base of the sequence, there's an erosion surface. Everyone agrees that that's an erosion surface. It's called the Great Unconformity. Everything else below that has been eroded off. And we can trace that erosion surface right across North America and to other parts of the world. It's almost a universal global erosion surface. And the first layer sitting on top of that erosion surface in the Grand Canyon is a sandstone. And that sandstone can be traced right across North America, right up into Canada, across to Greenland. We find the same sandstone sitting on the same erosion surface right across North Africa. I can take you to southern Israel in the Negev, and I can show you several locations where this erosion surface is exposed with exactly the same crystalline granite rocks below and the same sandstone above. And I mean, that's exactly what you'd expect. If a global flood occurred, you'd expect to find marine creatures buried on the continents and in layers that stretch right across continents on a global scale. By the way, the marine fossils are found on the continents. The creatures lived on the ocean floor. We don't find them buried en masse or on all the ocean floors. In fact, there's very little sediment on the ocean floors. Underneath, we've got volcanic rock. We haven't got the fossil layers with the marine fossils in them. They're up on the continents. Many of the other layers in the Grand Canyon area, such as the Red Wall Limestone, which is a prominent cliff that forms a red wall halfway up the cliffs of the Grand Canyon. That can be traced northwards up through Wyoming, can be traced right across North America. We see it again in the Appalachians. We can see exactly the same limestone with exactly the same fossils in Ireland, in Britain. We find it over in Europe and right across to the Himalayas. I mean, that's astounding. Now, the interesting thing is that mainstream geologists are aware of these issues, but these evidences, but they don't connect the dots. You know, we find these billions of marine fossils buried in rock layers, laid down by water all over the continents, and these are marine fossils. Another one of the layers I can talk about is the chalk beds that we find in Europe. We find them exposed in the cliffs, the White Cliffs of Dover, and on the southern English Channel coast. We find the same chalk beds stretch right across Europe, right down into the Middle East. We see them exposed in Israel, Kazakhstan, Egypt. The same chalk beds are found in the Midwest and Nebraska of the U.S., from Texas to Nebraska, from Arkansas and Alabama across to Colorado. And we also find the same chalk beds with the same fossils in southern Western Australia. And the chalk is a type of limestone, and it's full of marine fossils. In fact, it's made up of tiny little microscopic shellfish, trillions of them. But the interesting thing is that the geologists say that if the present is the key to the past, the present-day analog for the formation of this chalk is the ooze that we find in the ocean floor today that accumulates at a fraction of an inch every 1,000 years. Well, there's a problem with that, because when we go to Kansas, the chalk in Kansas is called the Niobrara chalk, but it's the same chalk as we find over in England, which we have some of these fossils in England and in Europe. But in the Niobrara chalk in Kansas, not only do we find large fish, that we find fish 10, 12, 14 feet long with other fish swallowed and undigested in their stomachs. We find buried with these large fish turtles 10 and 12 feet across. We find pliosaurs, which are marine reptiles. We find birds, and we find dinosaurs. How can we get dinosaurs buried with turtles unless the ocean waters flooded over the continents? And if it was a fraction of an inch every 1,000 years, as the present is the key to the past mentality says, that can't explain burying a fish that's 12 feet long with another fish undigested in its stomach. I mean, that's the other evidence we find. Lots of evidence that fossils had to form rapidly. I mean, how do you form a fossil? Do you leave a dead cow out in the paddock waiting to be covered up slowly that then becomes a fossil? No. It rots. It's eaten by scavengers. Everyone agrees that you have to bury the creature quickly. Oh, some people say, oh, but if it's in a putrid environment where there's no oxygen, it might survive. No. Even in a putrid environment, you've got bacteria that don't need oxygen, that feed off the organisms that are dead, and they will disintegrate them in no time at all. I mean, we find in the fossil record fish eating fish still undigested in their stomachs. We find fossil wasps. We find fossil flowers. I mean, things that normally would disintegrate very rapidly, we find them preserved. We find fossilized footprints. I mean, you leave a footprint on the beach in the sand or in a desert, and it's quickly obliterated by the forces at work with the wind and water. It has to have been buried quickly, otherwise it would get obliterated. The interesting thing is, and we see this in the Grand Canyon as well, as we go up the record, we find at the base only marine fossils. And then as we go higher up in the walls of the Grand Canyon, we don't find any land animals, but we first of all find the footprints of land animals. We don't find their bodies preserved until higher in the record. How is it that you would have creatures leaving their footprints and then the same creatures being buried millions of years later? It makes more sense if there was only days or weeks at the very most between the footprints being left and the creatures being buried. It makes sense. If you've got a tidal oscillation, you'd have the tides during a global flood with high tide and low tide. You're also going to have earthquakes that cause tsunamis. So water levels are going to rise and they're going to fall. Animals get swept away. They're swimming in the water. The water level drops. They find some exposed mud or sand. They leave their footprints. And then the next surge of water bringing in sediment buries their footprints and preserves them, picks them up, carries them away, and then subsequently, they expire and die and are buried in layers above that. And we see that repeatedly in the fossil record. We find the footprints of birds before we find their fossils. I mean, how do you fossilize a bird slowly? It has to have fallen out of the sky and been covered up very, very, very rapidly. So these are the evidences that we see in the canyon. Now, I've also looked at one of the projects I did was involved in using radiometric dating, that is radioactive elements in the rocks, which the geologists use to date rocks at millions and millions of years. And so often what they do is they'll take samples of a particular rock unit and they'll subject it to only one of the methods, because there's a number of them. There's uranium decays to lead, and there's potassium that decays to argon, there's rubidium that decays to strontium. Now, according to the theory of the methods, how they're supposed to work is that when, say, a volcanic eruption occurs, then the molten rock starts to cool and crystallize. These radioactive elements get locked into the crystals, but the product, the daughter product elements, are not in the crystals until after the rock solidifies and the parent elements, the uranium and the potassium and the rubidium, start decaying to lead, to argon, and to strontium. And so the idea is that no matter which clock you chose, they all started at time zero with only the parent, or an amount that we know of, we can figure out, and then in time you're going to increase the amount of daughter. So today we can it's like the sand grains falling the top of an hourglass from the top to the bottom. Okay, you've got an hourglass, the sand grains at the top fall, and in an hour they all get to the bottom. Well, if you come in halfway through the process, half the grains are at the top and half are at the bottom. So it's like that. The geologists measure how many grains, top sand grains there are, how many bottom sand grains, parent, daughter, to figure, and if they know the rate at which the decay process occurs today, then they can back calculate to the time when the process started. Well,
okay.
We decided
I'm sorry to interrupt, Dr. Snelling. We're up against the break here.
Okay, no problem. We can come back to it again in a moment.
Yeah, but 3 minutes is all. This is fascinating, and I'm looking at this like an investigator. My profession as an investigator, Dr. Mm-hmm. Snelling is laying out for you, ladies and gentlemen, to me, in my vernacular, the forensic evidence that the Bible and the God in the Bible, and the Bible is accurate, the God in the Bible spoke in the Bible, and what you're seeing, what he's presenting to you, is evidence to support the authenticity of the Bible. Folks, we're right back. Stay right where you're at.
This Thursday edition of the Hagman and Hagman Report, we are joined by the men from Answers in Genesis. That's answersingenesis.org. Our guest right now is Dr. Andrew Snelling. He's a geologist, and we're going to jump right back into it. Mr. Snelling, we have about 10 minutes until the next guest, Dr. Nathaniel Jensen, comes on. So go ahead and continue, please.
Yeah. I was telling you about the radioactive dating methods, and basically the theory says that they should all give you the same date on a rock, no matter which method you use. So we decided to test that in the Grand Canyon, and we chose four different rock units, and we found when we got the results that the different methods all gave different results. In fact, one volcanic rock unit gave an age of 516 million years by the potassium-argon method, an age of 1,111 million years by the rubidium-strontium method, and an age of 1,588 million years by another method. So one method was three times the age of the other. And the other interesting thing is all the methods gave different results on the same rock units, on the same samples, and yet there was a systematic pattern that indicated that nuclear decay rates may well have been faster in the past during a catastrophic event, and that fits with the biblical account of the flood. We are also suspect of the methodology for the radioactive dating, because there are volcanoes in the western Grand Canyon that erupted so recently, the lavas flowed down the walls of the canyon and temporarily blocked the Colorado River. Those lavas, there's remnants of them there today, and you can still see the volcanic cones on the rim. Those lavas give an age by rubidium strontium of the same 1,143 million years compared to the ancient lava flows in the other end of the Grand Canyon, the right down the bottom. They give you the same rubidium strontium age. And yet, so why should the youngest volcanic rocks in the Grand Canyon give you the same rubidium strontium age as the oldest rocks in the Grand Canyon? The answer is they came from the same source, and the rubidium strontium is a measure of the composition of the source, not the age of the rock. So This is what's so fascinating about this whole debate, is that we can point to lots of evidence that shows problems with the dating methods, with how the rock layers formed. One of the points of controversy in the canyon is a rock layer that's near the top of the canyon called the Coconino Sandstone. And it is a whitish-coloured sandstone unit. And within the horizontal bed that goes for mile after mile through the canyon, we see these sloping patterns, sloping lines within the sandstone. Everyone agrees that these are remnants of the way the sandstone was deposited. The conventional wisdom is that it was deposited by sand dunes, that is, sand in a desert where the wind blows and heaps it up into dunes, and the sand falls over the top as the wind blows it over the top, and you get these slopes. Well, those lines in the sandstone are the fossilized slopes of those dunes. Well, the same sort of thing can happen underwater. In fact, if you were to jump off the Golden Gate Bridge, and I don't recommend it, but if you went down with scuba diving under the Golden Gate Bridge, you'll find the sand on the bottom of the channel there is heaped up by the current coming in from the Pacific Ocean into San Francisco Bay. It heaps up and moves the sand in underwater sand waves. Now, the interesting thing is the slope that's caused by the advancement of a dune underwater is different to the slope with a dune being advanced under air. In air, the slope at the front is always between 30 and 34 degrees, whereas underwater, it's usually around 25 degrees or less. And so here we can set up an empirical test. How was this sandstone in the Grand Canyon deposited? Was it in air? By in a desert environment? Which, of course, the conventional community says, a desert. You couldn't have a desert during a global flood. But we say, no, the evidence points to water deposition. Let's go and measure the angles. If these angles of these sloping layers within the sandstone are 30 to 34 degrees, that must have been in the desert. If it's 25 degrees or less, it must have been underwater. Well, you know what? You go out there, and one of my friends who's a geology professor at Cedarville University, he and his students have been measuring several hundreds of these angles in different parts of the canyon and different parts of the region in this sandstone. And you almost invariably always, it's 25 degrees or even as low as 15 degrees. And yet this has been in the literature way back in 1938 and 48. There's records of measurements that give you the same answer. Yet the sad thing is, in this book that's now being promoted in the national park by presenting the Long Ages view, they're claiming the angles point to a desert dune. And we're challenging these guys, go out and measure the angles, because we've done that and seen their own literature that the angles are at the angle of which you get water deposition. Now, the interesting thing is we can also, from laboratory experiments and from observing these underwater waves, sand waves, that we find them in Long Island Sound as well, off New York, you can actually work out the water currents and the water depths that would be responsible for moving the sand along in those waves. And when you do the math, you can show that this sandstone bed in the Grand Canyon would have formed in a matter of days to weeks at the very most. And this sandstone bed is being traced not only around the Grand Canyon area, you can trace it all the way up to the Canadian border and further east into Kansas, Oklahoma, and elsewhere. It covers an area of nearly a million square miles. It's incredible the amount of sand, yet the evidence internally within this sandstone indicates that it would have been deposited rapidly. And that's totally consistent with a global flood. So that's why we are disappointed that the Park Service is not giving us the opportunity for our materials to be made available to people in the park so that they can see what the evidence decide for themselves between the two viewpoints as to how the layers in the canyon form and how the canyon itself was carved out.
You know, as we prepare for the next guest, Dr. Jameson, you just laid out the science. I mean, through your research, top-notch research, you just laid out the and via Answers in Genesis, laid out the fact that what we've been told, you've proved what we've been told, taught, and even advertised through the materials is a lie. And you have the truth, and they're saying, no, we're going to go with our version instead. But you, as a scientist, accredited, high-ranking, A-list scientist, you say, no, this is what the science shows.
And it just shows you what people's beliefs will do, how their beliefs will stop them looking at the evidence and properly assessing the evidence.
Okay. And this is not something that, I mean, all right, where can people find your specific work, Dr. Snelling? Where, answersingenesis.org.
Yes, on our website, yes, there's resources there. If they look on my name, they'll actually find there's DVD presentations. There's also a two-volume book called Earth's Catastrophic Past, Geology, Creation, and the Flood. And that's my primary work, where I lay out all these evidences in the canyon and elsewhere around the world, deal with all these sorts of issues, evidence that the world is in fact young, not the millions of years that we've been taught.
Isn't that great? And I've heard this before, just never as succinct as you have made it. And bravo to the brilliant presentation on this.
Well, thanks for giving us the opportunity to share this with your listeners.
God bless you, Dr. Snelly. I mean, fantastic. Thank you so very, very much.
It's a pleasure. And, thanks for the opportunity.
Wow. Well, thank you. Okay, folks, that was Dr. Snelling, answersingenesis.org. That alone, just that slice of, again, I'm an investigator, so I look at the entire world, will say, and specifically as he was talking about the Grand Canyon as a crime scene, and the forensic evidence which he brought forth to me verifies, validates the I don't want to sound demeaning to the Bible. If the Bible was a statement, a witness statement, or a statement that verifies that statement, and you need that. We don't need it. We've got faith. But when you're talking to an atheist or agnostic or someone who's just out to lunch, there it is. That's just one aspect of this. And this is such a tremendous, well-needed program. We're taking a break, of course, from the insanity that's out there with respect to the elections, to talk about something that will enrich us, intellectually enrich us, and is enriching us. And this is great. Next, we have up Dr. Jameson.
Dr. Nathan Jensen.
Jameson.
A biologist. Jameson, I'm sorry. A biologist with answersingenesis.org, and my computer, I had to restart it. So
we want to thank, too,
sure
Larry Ross Communications, as well as John Robertson, for setting this up. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Do we have Dr.
Mr. Jameson, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
All right. Perfect.
And we apologize for mispronouncing your name. It's Jameson, correct?
Yes, sir. I respond to many things, so it's no problem.
Well, welcome to the Hagman and Hagman Report. Just if you want to give a brief introduction of yourself, and we're going to let you take this in presentation form at the top of the hour. We've got about a 3-minute break, but the next 40 minutes is yours to take us where you want. So just open up with a little bit about yourself, and of course that can be found at answersingenesis.org, but just introduce yourself to our audience, please.
I grew up in a Christian, I could say, creationist home. I was homeschooled through 8th grade, and when I went off to high school, there were 3 Christian school options in my area, only one of which taught the view that I hold to currently and the view of the organization I have. So I've known the creationist position from an early age, but I'd say I also have known the evolutionary position from an early age, because what organizations like Answers in Genesis do and have done for so many years is teach you both sides so that you see the flaws of evolution, so that when kids like myself go off to college, when I went off to college, it won't be a shock to hear it for the first time, but have answers ready for professors who pose questions, for classmates who pose questions. And so when I went off to undergraduate college, a secular college, and Wisconsin, University of Wisconsin, Parkside, was prepared. Biology 101, 102 could take the questions to the professor, wasn't surprised by it, and there wasn't ever really a crisis of faith because everything that I heard was stuff I had been prepared for ahead of time. Went off to Harvard, did a PhD in biology, graduated 2009, and joined a different creationist organization, the Institute for Creation Research, founded by Henry Morris. He and Whitcomb, John Whitcomb, wrote the book, The Genesis Flood, that many view as the catalyst for the modern young earth creation movement back in 1961, and I joined Answers in Genesis and the Creation Museum about a year ago.
Thank you for that. All right. Wow. So yeah, you're just a nobody. Yeah. just a guy with an opinion. No. It's amazing to me that, and in a course setting too, it's amazing sometimes you can get scientists for hire. You know, if you've got an agenda to push, you can buy a scientist. But in this case, not so much, because you've got a number of things behind you as well. Okay, so Answers in Genesis, what is your part in this? And what's your specific area of, well, just go ahead and take it. Presentation's all.
So I'd say the major creationist organizations have several arms to them. There's an educational arm, and various organizations take different approaches to that. Like when I was at the Institute for Creation Research, they were offering Masters of Christian Education to take a little bit more of an academic approach. Answers in Genesis, of course, has the Creation Museum, now the Ark Encounter, to reach the larger populace. The Creation Museum largely targets probably more of a believing audience who don't yet see the relevance of Genesis and why it matters to their faith, why it matters to the integrity of Scripture, why it matters to salvation and other really big issues to a Christian. Whereas the Ark Encounter is, we've sort of stripped down the Christianese to reach out and engage those who have never heard of this before or heard of it growing up and have rejected it and have never really thought hard about it, to engage them where they're at and to get them to think and to educate them along the way. And to get them to dig deeper. So that's one arm, an educational arm. There's a branch of that as well in our speaking engagements going around the country, on weekend conferences and churches, or other part of other bigger conferences. And there's a research arm, which is really my primary role here behind the scenes. And I'd say that there's two motivations for what I do. One is, science is always changing, and so the evolutionists and our opponents are continually coming up with new ways to try to buttress their ideas or to undermine Genesis, and those really go hand in hand. And so to keep up to date with what they're saying and to be relevant so that the people we're educating and ministering to are prepared, so that people like me, the next generation, can go off to college and be prepared for what they're about to hear in the classroom. And the second part of that is, while we start with Scripture, there are many things the Scripture doesn't say. The Bible doesn't say exactly what God created in Genesis 1. It uses the term kind. But we can get from Genesis chapter 6 a little bit of a sense for what a kind might be, some criteria for identifying it. For example, Noah's told to take male and female on board the ark for the purpose of them reproducing after the flood. So if we can find creatures that are reproductively compatible, that might identify what species even are part of the same kind. So one reason for doing research is to keep up to date, to have ready answers for the new attacks that come up. And secondly, is to fill in the blank, so to speak, to investigate areas in which Scripture is silent. And my training specifically is in biology and heavily in genetics. At least that's the research I'm doing right now. And the question I'm focusing on primarily is really the question that started the entire debate. So when Darwin wrote his book, it was on the origin of species. That was his goal, to explain where species came from. In 1859, over 150 years ago, the context in which he lived, the scientific context, largely viewed species as static entities. And you can see, when you think about it, where this idea might come from. If you reflect on it, you can see that species have a very good fit with their environments. Take polar bears. They have a white coat. They have all sorts of aspects of their biology that make them well-suited to the Arctic. And Arctic foxes, Arctic hares, you know, their white coats, they blend in very well. Predator-prey relationships, they fit that Arctic environment. It's as if they were designed to live there. And if you move further south, bears, foxes, rabbits change. You got black bears in North America, red fox in Eurasia, basically Europe and Asia. Rabbits, of course, all over the world of different colors. They're not white because they're not primarily in a snowy environment. Instead, they fit the environments in which they live in very well. So, again, that you reflect on that for a few minutes and you think, well, maybe they were designed for this. Maybe they were made for this environment. So the views of Darwin's day were that God created each species in its current environment. To explain why they fit so well. And Darwin came along and basically tried to repudiate all that. He rejected not only this idea that they were that their environments were fixed and unchanging, but so he said they migrated to their current locations, but then of course also said all species go back to a common ancestor. And that's what was so revolutionary. So what many people don't realize is he never had any direct data to answer his question. You think about the origin of species. What are species? I mentioned a few examples. Polar bears, Arctic foxes, Arctic hares. Well, what is a species? It's basically a group of distinct creatures that we recognize, and we recognize them by their features. The polar bear is white fur, the Arctic fox is white fur, the Arctic hare is white fur, and so forth. Well, the reason that there's a whole bunch of them that we can recognize is because those traits are preserved. A polar bear reproduces and it produces more polar bears. Arctic foxes produce Arctic foxes. Humans produce humans. There's this consistency generation after generation. So really, if you're asking what's the origin of species, you're asking what's the origin of those traits that are consistent from generation to generation. That's a question of inheritance. And inheritance is recorded directly in only one scientific field. Anatomy and physiology doesn't record it. Fossils don't record it. Geography doesn't record it. Only genetics does, which we now know to be the genetic code for us is in our DNA. Well, in 1859, right, No one had the slightest idea what the physical basis for heredity was. The observations that Gregor Mendel, the Austrian monk, made that begin most genetics textbooks. He didn't publish his results till 1866, depending on which source you consult. That's the start of most genetic textbooks, and all Gregor Mendel did, it was a monstrous undertaking. He made massive observations with pea plants, but really all he did was say this is how traits behave consistently in a mathematically predictable way. We didn't trace that to the molecule DNA really until 100 years later. So long after Darwin died, the scientific community for the first time in 1953 recognized DNA as the substance of heredity. This is where a creature's inheritable traits, that's the means by which they're passed on. And then, of course, it would take another several decades to get the DNA sequence, the letter-by-letter code for our arms, legs, hair, so forth, for each creature. For example, the human DNA sequence wasn't discovered until 2001. Recently, and the human DNA is the best studied genetic species, the best studied species at the genetic level on the planet. So you can see just how recent the genetic data for a whole bunch of species has been. So think about that.
Yeah, 15 years. 15 years. That's all. 15 years.
We haven't had the direct scientific data to evaluate the origin of traits, which means the origin of species, until really right now. So that's the research I'm doing, really revisiting Darwin's original question with direct data for the first time.
Wow. Okay. We got about 2 minutes to the top, or 4 minutes to the top of the hour. So, okay. Yeah, wow. You just said like a whole bunch of stuff. my daughter, who's really big into biology and zoology, is listening intently, and wow. Okay, so what you're saying is no evolution, obviously. This is not evolution. Look, I'm not the brightest bulb here. If you were to summarize what you just said in a couple of sentences, how would you articulate that? Because I know what I want to say, but I don't think I could say it as eloquently as you.
I would say that many people don't realize Darwin took a gigantic scientific risk when he wrote The Origin of Species. And I don't mean the scientific risk that every scientist takes, because the scientific method is you take a guess and then you do experiments to see if you're right or wrong. Every scientist takes risk. But in this case, Darwin took a guess. He gathered indirect data. He then argued very vigorously for his conclusions 150 years before he'd have any direct data to say yay or nay. That's
wow.
Something the evolutionist will not want to talk about too much, because if you say, oh, Darwin took a risk, what you're basically admitting is the last 150 years we've been arguing about side issues. When, of course, the narrative we're supposed to be taught is Darwin established the evolutionary model 150 years ago and no one's questioned it since.
You could say what the area of argument is are red herrings. I mean, it's... And I'm understanding this a little bit better. And I think, you know, folks, listen to what this gentleman is saying here with respect to Darwin, and it's almost, it's pushing a religion via, I guess, you know, the theory of evolution or the religion of evolution via Darwinism. And of course, you know, folks, we've had Paul McGuire on to talk about how Darwin fits into the model of the non-biblical worldview in which we are having it thrust down our throats, and you're doing a very good job. So everything that we've been told is based on a guess, but it's presented as fact. Everything we've been told via Darwin, based on a guess, presented as fact, and taught as doctrine. But yet your research has shown that it's the biblical account of creation and not the Darwinian account of evolution.
Yes, and what they're presenting as fact is an argument supported by indirect data, when in fact, you know, really Darwin threw out a hypothesis 150 years ago, and it's been a hypothesis for 150 years, and now we can finally evaluate it for the first time.
And this goes to Genesis, Answers in Genesis. And folks, that's the website for Dr. Jensen, answersingenesis.org. But the Answers in Genesis, which you just, the information that you provided, the species information, preceded by, of course, Dr. Snelling's geographic information, now we are the totality of evidence, not that we need supporting evidence to verify the authenticity of the Holy Bible, but when you are in, like, when you're fighting these doctrines, these false doctrines, when you're fighting these facts or things that are presented as facts in Yale and Harvard and all these schools of higher learning, these are the people who have the answers that will allow you to refute the false doctrines of these big league universities and the perversion of not just our faith, but of our worldview. Folks, you're listening to the Hagman and Hagman Report. What a great, what a refreshing, and I mean refreshing, change here away from the elections to talk about this very important topic. 3 minutes, we're going to be right back with more from Dr. Jensen. Stay right where you're at.